Track session number 10657, rule 21.
Major Lewis, rule 21. You were describing the layout of your company. You said you had two platoons up and one in reserve.
Yes. There were two platoons up and one in reserve, and I moved level with the two leading platoons. I had on my left was the right-hand section of the left-hand platoon. On my right was the left-hand section. I had a navigator with me for direction, but mainly to count the paces, because that was really the only way to tell that we had gone the full distance. All the companies had somebody counting the paces, and he came from the intelligence section. I also had my batman with me, and I also had the three platoon runners. So it was a forward company headquarters of just a small sort of battle group. Now, back with, alongside the reserve platoon, was main company headquarters, where was the company second in command, the company sergeant major, the signallers with the 18 set, the stretcher bearers. And as I say, they were fairly close to the reserve company.
How were the two forward platoons laid out? Were they
two sections up and one back? That's always the, at least at that time, that was always the method.
What formation were they in? Were the sections in line?
They were lined up. They were lined up along the tape. I think I'm right in saying, and we can check this later on, I think that a company occupied about 150 yards in width. Now, you've got four sections occupying that width. So you've got seven or eight men to each section, something like that. They've got about 30 men on 150 yards is about 5 yards to each man. But it couldn't be any more than that, because it was very important. Well, it was very important before we did the attack to try and keep them fairly close together. So it brings out another point here, that the companies having to move as closely together as that were leaving pretty big gaps, and the gap could become bigger between two companies when casualties occurred, which meant that we overran at a later stage some German positions who carried on firing after we had actually gone through,
because no one had actually walked over them.
That's right. So that the reserve company had to deal with them, or even the reserve battalion eventually. We also had some Germans who actually turned round and opened up on us when we'd gone, and they had to be dealt with straight away.
Was the reserve platoon also in?
It would have been in the same formation. Yes. It was an easy formation to operate. It's a back to front arrow, really. You've got the two sections up and the one back. It's a good, for that sort of attack, it's exactly right. I mean, basically, what you're looking at, supercharge, was a First World War attack. It was lining the infantry up in a straight line. And when the whistles went, they started walking. And they kept on walking until they got to the objective.
In a platoon layout, in an attack like that, what was the distance between the two front sections and the one following them?
Oh, I think they would have been about... The one following wouldn't have been all that far back, I don't think. Probably, certainly not more than about 30 or 40 yards, I'd have thought. They had to, you know, you've got to have some sort of, you've got to try and exercise some sort of control, whatever the conditions.
And at platoon level, I presume the control was mainly by shouting.
Under normal circumstances, but you'll see later on that it was very, very difficult. The noise was absolutely deafening, and really, it was as much as you could do just to keep moving and try and make sure that you were going forward at a reasonable pace, not out distancing anybody else. I mean, you couldn't shout back to the reserve platoon. Certainly you couldn't do that, not once we got moving.
But a platoon commander presumably would be able to shout to his...
Oh yes, a platoon commander. You see, you've got your three sections to the platoon. Now the platoon commander, I'm almost certain both of my officer, all my platoon commanders moved with one of those sections. They had to be at the front of the platoon, not at the back.
So they would really have been between... Would they have been normally between the two forward sections?
Could be, in a similar sort of thing to what I was doing, actually, by being between. You could have had a situation like that. But they were pretty close to the front of their sections because at that... Well, I don't remember any other stage when we didn't do it. But we always reckon that that's where the officers have got to be, leading the blokes, not stuck back somewhere. Not if they were companies or platoons. Anyway, we had nearly 2 hours to wait. 0 hours, 5 minutes past one in the morning, and it was very cold. It used to get very cold in the desert, but this was no exception, November. And the troops had only got shorts and shirts and pullovers. So it really was very cold indeed, and that can be a bit demoralising. So when they bought the rum ration round at 12:45... It was a good rum ration, it was an ample one, so everybody was able to warm themselves up on that. One of my NCOs, who used to be in the Merchant Navy, complained bitterly that the rum wasn't up to the same standard as he'd had in the Navy, which caused a bit of a laugh. It was little things like that that got the blokes laughing, you know, and helped morale. And by this time, of course, the German Very Lights had been going up quite a lot, and the RAF aircraft flares joined them as RAF bombers started to pound the gun lines and the German transport. So we had this firework display going on ahead of us, the Very Lights and the flares and the bombers droning overhead. So at 12:55, this is 10 minutes before 0 hour, A and B companies spread themselves out along the tapes. So you have then got four platoons actually spread out along the tape, two platoons from one company and two from another. Bayonets were fixed. It went very, very quiet, or seemed to go very, very quiet once we were all standing there ready. It was a sort of calm before the storm, and then we had this extraordinary sight that nobody will ever forget who was there. Behind us, I suppose about a dozen or so guns opened up to start with. You just got the flash. It was a sort of boom, 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 boom. I suppose they were the lead guns or whatever. And then almost immediately, the full weight of this absolutely fantastic barrage. And the troops just sat down where they were and look behind them, because the whole of the sky to the east was pierced by hundreds of gun flashes, one after the other, punching into the night. And it was absolutely, it really was something terrific that I'd never seen before, and neither had they. But of course we didn't have very long to wait, because 1:05 went, the whistles blew. Now, shells were already going over us, like, you know, screaming over and whistling. The whistles blew and off we went. And I made in my notes here that it was a frightful, shattering crescendo of noise that almost defies description, which it was. And this was going to go on for 3 hours. There were shouted commands, as because everybody was fairly close together at that stage, as the infantry closed up on the barrage, which had been stationary on the opening line for 20 minutes. So all we did initially was not to go very far. We had to wait for a little while before the smoke shells were fired, which meant that the barrage was going to move. Now, it says 20 minutes, but that seems rather a long time to me, but that's what it says. So when the smoke shells were fired, they actually caused more confusion than they were worth, because at the same time the barrage lifted and started to creep forward. So on that reckoning, the barrage lifted and started to creep forward at about 1:25, and as soon as it lifted and went, then A and B companies started walking, and straight away where we were into the smoke from the smoke shells, there was dust and muck thrown up by the barrage floating around all over the place. It absolutely stank of the smell of high explosives, which had got a lot of the troops were coughing and spluttering as they went forward. And I remember that from the left flank we heard the bagpipes as one of the Scottish battalions went forward, and also the sound of a hunting horn from a DLI company commander on our left, who always carried his hunting horn whenever he went anywhere. We went over the Australian wire into what we can call no man's land. That's the wire, soon after leaving the start line. The German Variolites went up almost immediately, or they'd already started going up, 3, 4, 5, 6 in quick succession, calling for the German defensive fire. They were frantic SOS signals, which were answered by artillery and machine guns, which had somehow survived the British barrage. At this stage, a lot of our chaps were hit, and men were stumbling and falling as the Spandos opened up on fixed lines. They were firing, of course, into the smoke and the dust. They couldn't see what they were firing at. But if you were unlucky enough to be on a fixed line, that was it. And the chaps were beginning to go down quite a lot.
What about artillery? Was there a lot of that landing amongst
Not a lot, no. There wasn't, funnily enough. I think had there had been, we'd have had heavier casualties. But there, I don't recollect that there was a lot of artillery coming down. Perhaps at that stage we were a little bit further into no man's land than they had expected us to be. There could have been something coming down on the battalion headquarters area, maybe, or back towards
the gun. Or it's conceivable that the counter-battery fire could have been effective.
Could be, because there would have been a lot of counter-battery fire in all that. But certainly the only shelling I remember was a shell that was dropped, the shells that were dropping short on the right, very near the right-hand section in a very early stage, and we pulled the section in.
What about mortars? Did the Germans bring those down on you as well?
Can't recollect that, no.
So it was mainly the Spandaus that were doing the harm?
About the Spandaus on the fixed lines that were doing the damage, in actual fact. But the two companies kept close up behind the barrage. B Company was particularly hard hit in the vicinity of the Australian wire. Both my officer platoon commanders were killed, one by a mine that was actually in the Australian wire. Now, whether it had been put there by the Aussies or whether it had been put there by the enemy, I don't know. But anyway, it was actually in the wire itself. So I'd lost my two leading platoon commanders almost as soon as we'd started the attack. They'd only joined the 8th Battalion, I think, 2 days previously or something like that. So it was their first time in action.
How did you manage to keep direction? Because you mentioned the Germans were firing blind into the smoke and the dust. Did you march on a compass bearing? Or?
Well, there was only... I mean, officers had compass. I'd got a compass with me, so we were using a compass bearing while my chap was pacing and that. But really, it was simply a question of walking fairly slowly, trying to keep view of the man on the left of your right and just walking. And I think the line up to that point anyway, had kept fairly straight, really. Don't forget that we had got the Beauforts firing every 2 minutes, and you could see this red tracer streak over, so you knew you were going in the right direction. It wasn't easily. Now, we had a Spandau right in front of us, immediately in front of B Company. A very light went up, and the Spandau opened up on a fixed line, but for some reason or other, he was firing high. Whether he was firing on a fixed line which was supposed to be firing high over into the battalion headquarters area, I don't know. But what it did do, it enabled several of my chaps to crouch down, run under the tracer and into the post, and they bayoneted the gun crew. So that disposed of that one. But it was an extraordinary thing with tracer. You could sometimes walk under it, you know, and know that it wasn't going to hit you because it was on one of these fixed lines. But that one was dealt with. And we eventually reached the single line of concertina wire which marked the German main positions. We could see then what the garage had done. There were dozens of shell holes. Some of them were only a few feet apart. And it was impossible for anybody who hadn't have been in a slit trench to have lived through that barrage. It just was not possible. The pattern of the gunfire was so close that there was no way. We found a lot of German and Italian dead. They were littered about all over the place. Some had obviously been caught out in the open by the barrage. Others had been hit by shell splinters and were hunched up in the slit trenches. We started taking prisoners of war then. They started coming back. Some of them were almost hysterical, even the Germans, who were a pretty tough lot. They'd been morally shattered, really, by the weight of this terrific barrage. And they walked about in a daze. You know, you'd see a figure come out of the smoke, and you'd see him turn round and sort of walk over there, and you'd suddenly realise he wasn't carrying anything. Unfortunately, it didn't happen always that way, because unless you could be dead certain that it was somebody unarmed, you had to shoot. You couldn't have people. So unfortunately, I think there's no doubt that one or two Germans who were just wandering about trying to give themselves up were shot, because we didn't know that that's what they were doing.
Did you come across many enemy wounded?
No, very few. Very few indeed. C Company, Ian English told me at a later stage, came across a German dressing station, and the German officer came out and explained in the broken English that this could have been back in the battalion headquarters area somewhere, so it was beyond where we were, that he was looking after wounded, and Ian English said, well, that's all right, you carry on. But I don't remember seeing any wounded at this particular point in time. We'd got into the German main positions, and I think that anybody who'd been hit there, it was dead. But we couldn't hang around there too long. We had to keep on going with the barrage, and this is the point I was making earlier, that having arrived in this area with all this dead lying around and checking the slit trenches and the dugouts and everything took a little bit of time, so it did slow us down a little. And of course the guys on your extreme flanks, the other company didn't know we were stopping. We didn't know they were stopping. So that by now, I would think, when they did stop, we had no way of telling. By now, the line was probably getting a bit ragged.
Out of dressing.
Sorry?
Out of dressing.
Yes, I think so. But we knew that we got to keep going with the barrage. We knew that we weren't supposed to consolidate yet. Some of the Germans put up quite a fight. I remember that one German came out of a dugout as though he'd been sort of shot out by some sort of launcher and was coming straight at me and with a pistol, I think it was, and one of the B Company section commanders got him with a burst of Tommy gun fire, and send him reeling back, but some of them were pretty tough. They were good, no doubt about it. I mean, they were good troops. Well-trained German troops were bloody good, and no doubt about that at all. I mean, there was another bloke who waited until we'd got beyond him, and he was, we probably thought he was dead as we went over him, but he just got enough strength left to chuck a stick grenade after us, and somebody went back and found that he was already dead then. But the line went on, and we'd been sadly depleted by then. We came to an area of HQ dugouts, burning vehicles. I told you about C Company reaching the casualty clearing station with the Red Cross flag. And on the right, Chris Beattie, as I think I said earlier on, was busy setting fire to abandoned German tanks by firing a Very pistol into the petrol tanks. Beyond Chris Beattie, the Maoris were having a field day. It was still very, very smoky and dusty. We were still stumbling over shell holes. As I said, anything that moved and came out of the dust, we shot. Most were firing from the hip, Bren guns as well, which once you knew the knack of it, you could fire from the hip. And as I say, just now and then, somebody came out of the mist to surrender. But as I said, who could tell that they were going to surrender until they got close enough? And if they got close enough to shoot at us, we couldn't take that chance. And basically, no quarter was asked, and none was given. I mean, our chaps knew that if they didn't kill what was in the dust and smoke, they would be. And it was every man for himself. And I think once we reached this headquarters area, that dozens of, well, perhaps not dozens, but a lot of individual firefights broke out between groups of Germans and DLI.
So
across the whole front.
Sounds like it was breaking up into,
yes, that's right,
small-scale skirmishes.
That's right.
Of handful of troops.
That's right, it was. Which I think was bound to happen. You couldn't ignore them. Something had to be done about it. And, of course, in all the noise and confusion, a lot of the men had gone down, and it hadn't even been noticed.
Were you aware of this happening as you were going along, that you were getting disorganised your numbers were falling?
Yes, but there was not much you could do about it. All you could do was to try and keep going with what was on your immediate left and right. Added to which, I suppose I was in a fortunate position, because I'd got something to think about. Officers and NCOs were better off than the poor old troops very often. They didn't have anything to think about. I got a responsibility to get to a particular objective, you know. And that was what mainly we were doing. I mean, I'd still got my pacer with me, and he was still pacing. I was still keeping direction. I knew that I'd got something on my left and right. I knew there was a lot of firing going on. We'd been involved in quite a bit ourselves, and it was all over the place. And at 2:30 in the morning, which was 1 hour and 25 minutes after the start of the attack, we arrived on the first objective, together with A Company, or at least A Company and B arrived on this mythical line, so many yards ahead. Both companies had very heavy casualties.
Was that on schedule, according to the plan?
I can't tell you. There must have been a time when we were supposed to arrive there, and I think that would probably have been worked out on the barrage, and the barrage wasn't all that far ahead, so we couldn't have been all that much behind it. I think we probably hadn't done too badly to do an hour and 25 minutes, although don't forget we didn't start until 1:25, so it was about an hour actually that we'd been walking, and I would have thought we were fairly well to time. We were able to take a rough count, because there was a pause in the proceedings on this first objective while the guns lifted and started pounding the area between the first objective and the final one. We estimated at that time, of the combined strength of A and B companies, nearly 100 men had been killed or wounded, and of the 8 officers of those 2 companies, 4 had been killed. So we'd lost 50% of our officers and 100 men killed or wounded. In A Company, there was only Chris Beattie, the company commander, and 1 platoon commander. And in my company, there was only me. And very soon after that, I collected a gunshot wound in the right thigh whilst attempting to reorganise the remnants of the company. Bullet went right the way through here, across the top of my kneecap, came out underneath.
So it came in through the...
Came in there.
Through just above your knee.
At an angle.
Right-hand side of your
right
thigh.
Yes, at an angle, almost as though somebody somewhere was maybe on top of a tank or something.
Someone was at shoulder height firing down at you.
Actually, yes. Something like that.
Were there any tanks or anything like that?
No, not that I can remember anyway. I mean, the whole thing just came out of the blue. One minute it was... walking around trying to get everybody together and lined up again, and then I had this bullet, which had an extraordinary effect of making my leg jump up and down, because it had knocked off quite a few nerves and I couldn't keep it still. It was kicking like mad, and I went down onto the ground and it was still kicking. But
so you didn't see any enemy in the vicinity?
No. But bear in mind, we're still in dust and smoke and everything. You're not talking about... You couldn't see what was happening beyond 40 or 50 yards. Could have been a stray bullet.
So it just came out of the...
That came out of the blue. Absolutely.
Do you know what kind of bullet it was?
No idea, because it went right the way through. I would have thought it might just have been an ordinary rifle bullet. I don't think it was. It couldn't have been a revolver bullet. It had to be a rifle bullet, I would have thought.
So you were on the ground. What happened to you then?
Well, there weren't a lot of men left in B Company, and A Company wasn't much better off. And at that point in time, both A and B ceased to exist as fighting formations, although isolated groups of both companies joined up with other, some with A Company, some with C Company, some probably with the left-hand battalion of the other Durham battalion, and they went forward to the final objective. So they still continued in the battle. Left me lying on the ground. And very, very soon, there was nobody else. I mean, you know, what had been quite a busy place a few minutes earlier suddenly became absolutely deserted. I had had a field dressing... put on my the entry hole and the exit, and I'd been, my revolver was near at hand, but I couldn't put any weight of any sort on the leg. It was completely finished because all the nerves had been cut. It stopped jumping by now, which was a frightening thing to watch, actually, whilst it was jumping about.
Who actually put the dressing on for you?
One of my chaps. I don't know who it was. It would have been one of them.
Did you lose consciousness at all?
No, I didn't. I didn't, no.
What happened then? Did your sort of company headquarters just carry on moving forward?
Well, I mean, we were on that first objective for a little while, for quite a while exactly, and I can't remember whether I was hit fairly soon after arriving there, I think it would probably have been about halfway through. So, having put a field dressing on, then the company, not having any other officers in the vicinity, this is where the sergeants come into their own, and the section commanders. They've got to get the chaps together again and get them ready to move off when it is time to go for the final objective. There isn't really any time to sit around looking after anybody or anything like that. So, I mean, all I could tell them was to, you know, get the two platoons, what's left of them, ready to move forward. I didn't know at that stage, having told them that there were so few of them, by the time they'd done that, that there was little else they could do other than tack themselves on to other units.
What happened to your batman then? Because one might have expected he would have stayed with you.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, there was no reason for him to. I was out of the battle, but there was no reason for him to stay with me. I didn't need anyone to look after me, you know. He would have gone on. He would have gone on.
Who then, in theory, would have taken over command of the company once you'd been wounded?
No officers left. None at all.
So it would have been the senior sergeant.
The senior sergeant. The senior sergeant.
What about the company sergeant major? Wasn't he?
He would have been back with rear company headquarters, and he would have come up with rear company headquarters, and I would almost certainly, I would have discussed the situation with him whilst I was lying on the ground.
But you don't remember doing
that? No, I don't. No. No, it's all a bit hazy, actually.